Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. I'm not sure if we have a quorum yet, so we'll wait on the minutes. But this is continuing a set of meetings that we're having, trying to get our handle on how the governor is going to be managing the budget as opposed to the particular items that are in our division in the governor's budget. So today we have the Department of Finances overview, continuing Department of Finances overview of the budget, of the governor's budget, and we're particularly interested in how the EBOs are going to be operating. So we're starting with Brian Dahl from the executive, however you guys are starting. Come up and tell us who you are and what you do and how everything is going to be just perfect this year.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Abigail Reed. I'm one of the budget officers at Minnesota Management and Budget.
Okay. Madam Chair, my name is Brian Dahl. I'm a executive budget officer with Minnesota Management and Budget.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angela Vogt. I'm an executive budget officer with Minnesota Management and Budget.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, members, we are three of the 12 budget officers at Minnesota Management and Budget, and our role there is to help coordinate the budget through the governor's process. So we actually kind of help work with agencies through that entire process. Then we provide information to the legislature like we are today. And we both provide some general information and then discussion on the governor's recommendations. We follow the legislative action to make sure that information is flowing through that process. And we work with agencies then to ensure that the enacted budget is implemented as you and the governor have directed. Today we're here to provide a general overview of the governor's budget recommendations. We're going to begin with a few slides from the governor's actual budget presentation. Then we're going to add some additional slides at the end that get into the agencies within your jurisdiction. So we are going to focus quite a bit on those agencies within your jurisdiction.
Okay.
And if we have time at the end, we're also going to just quickly run through what information is available to you in the budget document that I think staff has passed out for you. And just so you know, we're prepared to answer some general questions about how the governor's budget was put together for these agencies, but we oftentimes will think the agencies are a better source of information for your questions, and if that's the case, we'll note that and pass those questions along to the agencies for when they come before you later.
Okay, one of the things we've been particularly interested in is the issue of oversight of the, which you kind of had one line in, of is the agency following the budget recommendations, and are there things that are falling through the cracks that we should be taking a closer look at? And so one of the things I think we're interested in, what kind of a role you people feel you have to play in that area.
And Madam Chair, we can respond generally how budget officers participate in that process, but I'm unfortunately not prepared today to talk about that larger internal controls discussion. I do know that you've had the commissioner in and our deputy commissioner and folks. They're better able to address that. We're really here and able to talk about the governor's budget recommendations for the particular committee.
So you think that, how long have you people, various people, been EBOs?
In our particular case, it ranges from a couple years to relatively recent.
Okay.
And we actually typically have about 12 people and work with different areas of the budget. So each budget officer will have responsibility, similar to how your fiscal analysts work, responsibility for an area of the budget that they become familiar with.
Okay, and how long have each of you been with the Department of Finance as an EBO?
I've been 2.5 years, I think.
Okay. And
2.5 months.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, I've been in EBO since August.
Oh, okay. Okay, interesting. Has that been the usual turnover in the EBO, on the ranks of the EBOs?
Well, we have a range. I mean, people that we have range from 25 years to 2 months. I mean, it's definitely in turnover you would expect in any sort of job class, but in our particular area, budget officers across states tend to have a fairly higher turnover than you might get in a job class that's more stable. But that's kind of the nature.
Like the
of
legislative fiscal analyst.
For example.
Okay.
Different job classes have different characteristics. But
okay. Right. But we do have enough members from minutes representative for the approval of the minutes. Representative Mason moves. Okay. Moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Okay. Just keep on with your
presentation. Madam Chair, members, the first slide you can turn to has a pie chart on it. It shows the governor's proposed fiscal year 2010 and 11 budget. This is the general fund spending that's in the governor's proposed budget. So that would be $33.6 billion. And if you look down to the lower right-hand corner, the state government portion is 1.9%. And that's the state government portion in the governor's budget. I know there's some different characterizations of what agencies are included. This is for the governor's budget. You have a slightly different, as does the Senate. The next slide shows actually the proposed fiscal 10 and 11 all funds budget. So you'll see the general fund here is actually only 57.4%, and you'll see the other kinds of funds make up the remainder. So the total all funds operating spending would be $57.6 billion under the governor's proposed budget. And you might note here that this is all operating funds, so you won't see the revolving funds here that you typically review for the state government agencies. Also, the next slide shows Governor Pawlenty's top budget priorities.
Oh.
They are to enhance...
I was wondering, and maybe I am jumping ahead on this. I have had some coffee today, so... but I'm just wondering,
did you have coffee or you had too much coffee?
I think too much.
Oh, okay.
I'm very excited because two of my bills passed today, right?
Ooh.
Can you differentiate the one-time money? I mean, we have the $33.61 billion from the general fund spending, and we have the $57.648 from all funds, but can you differentiate or do you have an amount of what one-time money was used to balance budget?
I can't show you on this slide, Madam Chair and Representative Bigham, but we have a few slides later on that'll get at that.
So I did jump ahead.
Yeah. Okay. But if we don't get there, let me know and I'll slow down.
Okay.
So the governor's top budget priorities in this budget were to enhance Minnesota's job climate, to improve K-12 education, to protect state public safety programs, to maintain military and veterans programs, and to increase government reform and accountability. And the next slide shows within those there were some important financial management goals that the governor sought to achieve as well. The first one is the $250 million restoration to the budget reserve. That's in order to address the additional economic risks that we would face going into the next biennium. The next item is $350 million in the cash flow account. That would maintain our current level and the statutory limit in the cash flow account. The next item is to understate the potential level of federal fiscal assistance until it's finalized. There's been a lot of discussion about this. The governor's budget actually has a $920 million placeholder, and people have talked about as high as $3 billion. And this budget does not include that high of a placeholder. The idea is until it's finalized, we wouldn't want to overproject and then not have enough options on the table to solve the budget towards the end of session.
Thank you. We all know that there will likely be some need for a supplemental budget after the February forecast, which I understand is supposed to come out early the first week in March. If the stimulus package on a federal level is signed into law at that time, will the governor's supplemental budget reflect those true numbers as well?
Madam Chair, Representative, every attempt is going to be made to try to include that. Obviously, we want the forecast to represent all the things in current law. I think the bigger question is if it isn't by then what do we do? And that's really the challenge before us. But
all right, thank you.
Yep. The next slide from the governor's budget talks about some of the technology items in the budget, and these are all in your area, so that's why I included this one. The technology initiatives are to deliver services that the public expects, so to expand the number of licenses available online, to strengthen and improve the state's data centers, to finish building the integrated tax system, to replace outdated accounting and procurement systems, and to really try to match the enterprise IT costs with the longer-term benefits. And we'll talk a little more about that later in the presentation. And as you know, although it's a difficult time to invest in new technology to find the money, it's an important way to position the state for the future. The next slide.
Madam Chair, Ms. Reed, I guess the question I have on technology is, I think there are two ways that you could look at it. One is to improve the service being offered. In other words, improve the amount of control over where money is going and limit the access and all the things that the new finance system is supposed to provide. The other is to create more efficient service to save money. And I think both are good goals to have. I wonder if you could, maybe when we get to this, but kind of distinguish between ones that are intended to actually help save money in concrete budget terms versus those that are going to help improve the quality of service that finance or other core agencies are providing.
Okay. Madam Chair, I can address that when we get to the technical session. The next slide, then, shows a snapshot of the governor's budget solution, so the way that the governor's budget addresses the $4.8 billion deficit that was shown in the November forecast. And as you recall, the shortfall for this upcoming biennium is $4.8 billion, and the spending cuts and savings were $2.5. The other resources were $3.2. Tax cuts, initiatives, and reserve add back $860. Which brings us the total recommendation to $4.858 billion solution. That leaves actually a small balance of $11 million. The next few slides actually break that down a bit and show for the line that said spending cuts and savings, that's actually composed of permanent spending cuts. So this gets at the one-time question. The permanent spending cuts would actually be $2.368. The healthcare access fund and other savings that are occurring in other budget areas are $153 million. So the subtotal there is $2.5 billion. And the next slide actually shows the budget solutions that other resources line, and that's composed of the $920 million federal stimulus placeholder, the K-12 payment shift of $1.3 billion, the tobacco appropriation bond, which is a net amount of $983 million. So that subtotal is about 3.2.
You seem to have this continual problem about whether we're allowed to call them special appropriation bonds or not. Is there someone at some level going to decide that issue for us so that we don't have to keep casting for words?
Madam Chair, I fear that might be above my pay grade, but I can seeing as how it's been a pretty big debate. But the general gist is that they're both tobacco appropriation bonds or just appropriation bonds, depending on how you look at it.
Representative Taylor. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Reed, two questions on the second slide on four and then the other resources slide.
Okay.
I'll do the first on the second slide on four. The Healthcare Access Fund, I'm curious about why it's classified as a spending cut or savings rather than another resource.
Madam Chair, Representative, I may not be able to answer that question. It's outside of the area that I study, but I think it has something to do with the expenditures moving, and that's why. But I can definitely find out the answer and get back to the committee on that one.
I appreciate that. Thank
you.
And then the second question, Madam Chair, and Ms. Reed, is the federal stimulus placeholder, appreciating the desire to come in with a conservative number. I'm just wondering about if you've run the numbers on the impact of the Senate compromise in the Senate bill that I think they're passing as we speak. Oh, they passed it. Representative Bingham clearly had enough coffee today. They passed it. so I'm wondering if you know the numbers on the Senate bill in terms of whether we even hit the $920 million.
Senate Chair, Representative, we have staff that are studying the issue, but we don't personally have that information available here.
Just a quick comment on that, Madam Chair, on the energy stuff that we've been doing. The formula that we've been working out is about $1 billion equals about $17 million for Minnesota, just a general assumption that it's on formula block grants. And so if we're down to $39 billion total, that means that we're going to be below this 920 number, just doing rough calculations in my head. So I just you know, it creates more concern about, you know, we have to then backfill even more if that's the number that ends up being agreed to in compromise, in conference. So.
I think, actually, that problem of the state, that $40 billion or so difference to the state, I think there are still other parts of the bill that are still spending money to projects in the state that aren't covered in that. But that's something that's going direct to the state and local governments as opposed to programs that are being supported in other parts of the bill. I don't know.
And if I could, Madam Chair, just having gone through as much as I can, just on the energy side, mostly what we're looking at are very highly earmarked, or not earmarked, but tightly restricted block grants and program funds that, for instance, the state energy program can't be used to backfill the budget. It has to be used to deliver jobs. Energy efficiency community block grant, the same, you know, over and over and over, weatherization dollars. And looking at the other pieces in the bill, it looks like that's the case. And so that state aid seems to be the main backfill. I don't know if any of the three of you can comment if there are other pieces of that, of the spreadsheet that we should be looking at as well.
Well, I hope that, I don't know,
maybe
that that's a lot of good to look at the House one and the Senate one separately. I think we need to look.
Mm-hmm.
We need to look at what finally gets passed. If people are saying that that's going to happen, next week. So I think, and then I think, hopefully, the governor's office will, and our offices and our congressional staff, etc., will very quickly get to us what that means. So.
Side-by-side
take for
this bill.
Someone could do it
in a day. Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, there actually is a side-by-side online that's quite fascinating to click through. It gives you a headache very quickly, but it makes our work very simple.
Okay. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For any of the three, on the budget solution of the resources slide, does the tobacco appropriation bonds include the idea of not having a bonding bill this year and saving the money that it costs the state from not having one? Is that in that tobacco appropriation bonds net, or is that some other place?
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, the governor's budget does book savings from not recommending a bonding bill, so there's a certain amount of debt service cost that is in the forecast. And because the governor did not recommend the bonding bill, that is savings in the governor's budget. And that is actually a separate issue from the tobacco appropriation bonds. Those are entirely separate. The only place they have a relationship is when you then try to add up the total amount of cost of debt service in the governor's budget, you have to take into account some of these things.
Okay.
But the tobacco appropriation bonds will be used to pay the general fund debt service costs. And so the amount will be based on that.
Okay, just one follow-up, Madam Chair. Is there anybody in the office that's reviewing, I know there's been some discussion about the tobacco appropriation, kind of pain in the head or whatever. Do we have somebody looking at whether or not that is indeed appropriate to do, or can we even do it, like, legally? Is there somebody looking at that?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative, our Treasury Division has been working with lawyers both at the AG's office and at Dorsey & Whitney, our state bond counsel, and so they've been working with them to develop the proposal.
My slightly uninformed guess on that is that there's nothing illegal about it. The issue is, can they be sold, and at what interest rate can they be sold? It just doesn't make any sense. It's the bigger issue, not whether it's legal or not.
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, the only reason it is constitutional is because the proceeds from the bond sale are being used to pay off the debt on capital projects, which is why we're basically taking out a loan in order to pay the interest off another loan that we're taking, because the Constitution prohibits us from borrowing money for anything other than, I think it's held a threat of invasion or something, but in reality, the only thing we can borrow for is capital projects, which is why the only thing we can borrow the money from the future revenues for is to pay off the debt service.
on those bonds. So the question is, does it make sense to take out a MasterCard in order to pay your interest on your Visa card?
I think the word unconstitutional was the word I was looking for. Thank you, Representative.
Paying out the interest.
Yes. Okay, we need to assign a member of the committee to be on this issue completely, to totally defend it. Are there any volunteers? Governor's recommendation, guys. Someone ought to be comfortable with it. Okay. No, that's an unfair...
I'm sorry I arrived late. If you could explain what you're referring to, please.
We're referring to the tobacco appropriation bond. Is there any member of the committee? You don't have to do it today.
I believe Representative Downey has special expertise in this area.
You have to take it as a task through the course of the budgeting thing to be ready to defend it.
Madam Chair, I'm actually waiting for the Democrat budget, and I'll work from that budget.
Okay.
Representative, there will be no tobacco appropriation bond in the ultimate Democratic budget that will be passed out of the legislature. So you can still take on the task of defending this one, regardless of waiting for ours.
Do you know what that tax increase is going to be yet? Or?
No.
Madam Chair, to this point, and I think to bring our testifiers into the conversation a little bit. And this might seem a little bit wacky, but probably less so than the tobacco that we have in here. You know, going to this, a revenue source, especially through revenue bonding, which is in essence sort of, even though I know it's a weird hybrid approach to tobacco pieces, but I'm speculating, and I'm not 100% convinced that I could say that there's a full $983 million in energy savings opportunities in public buildings around the state, but I'm confident in saying that there's at least a third of that. And I'm wondering if there has been a discussion among the EBOs or above in actually doing a very, very aggressive energy savings revenue bond sale that could be used to backfill the budget as well as reduce our energy bill in all of our public buildings around the state. Not just our state-owned, but I think those that are state-created subdivisions at the local level, and the University of Minsk. I could actually get you the number of what the total revenue would be, but that may be an area where there may be a true public good achieved, as well as a backstop on the budget, as well as putting people to work very quickly. I'm not sure if we would have the capacity to go after all of it, but I imagine we could probably obligate all of that for a five-year period and borrow against that, and then go in and get the savings. Just wondering if that's even been run up the flagpole, and if it hasn't, I'd encourage you to do so, and I'm happy to help lead you to folks who have expertise in this area. I'd like to know whether it's being considered, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, is that being discussed in the Department of Finance, the issue of energy saving in the budget? As reflected in this budget.
And even, Madam Chair, energy revenue bonding through energy sales.
Just made it a more general.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's not a feature of the governor's budget that we're here to present today, but I know there have been some fiscal notes on the topic, and we've been engaged in that conversation. And there may be work being done at the agencies with that effect, but we wouldn't be prepared to talk about it today. But certainly through the fiscal note process or any other process, we could engage in that.
Representative Mason, did you have?
No.
Okay. Representative Holbert, did you have anything to say? Well, we've got these names on the list.
I'm sorry. Your point about looking for a homework assignment or whatever. I'm new to your committee, so I don't know if that's. If we have mandatory homework assignments, so that we're moving towards here.
I was just looking for a volunteer. I wasn't at that level yet. We get to the level. We've already figured out one on this side, but we'll...
I was just looking for a volunteer.
Oh. If there's any issue that comes before us that anyone is interested in pursuing further, you know, please do gladly assign it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is on the K-12 payment shift. Has any study been done to see then if this goes into effect, how many school districts will need to borrow against this withholding, and then what type of fiscal responsibility that would place on those school districts?
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't have that information with us today, but we can certainly talk with those budget officers and have them provide something to the committee.
Okay. Some of these issues are kind of strange because it's not clear if the responsibility of the education division or our responsibility because of financial implications. So I think that just as much information as you can get about them is useful. Okay. Let's go.
Madam Chair, members, moving to the slide, it's the second slide on page 5, budget pollution, tax cuts, initiatives, and reserves. This shows that that number breaks down with $323 million in new spending initiatives, $287 million in tax cuts, and then the $250 million restoration of the budget reserve. The statutory total for the budget reserve is $653 million, so this would be partially restoring that. So turning to the next slide then, the
question. In any of the discussion of the budget reserve, has anyone talked about replacing the budget reserve with a blink-on tax instead of a blink-on surcharge instead of a budget reserve? The theory is that you fill a budget reserve by taxing everybody to fill it. If you put a blink-on tax surcharge on when you need to fill it, so you don't pre-budget that, and you're only taxing those people who haven't been affected by the downturn that causes depletion of the budget reserve. So is that any kind of a discussion in the finance department?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any discussion on that topic recently, although I wasn't in all of the discussions on the budget reserve. In general, though, it's intended to be funds that are available on very short notice. It's when we have a forecast deficit and we need to act quickly. And so the goal is to have funds available as quickly as possible, and any situation where you'd have to go out and actually institute a tax or do anything else to receive the money would make that a challenge.
Madam Chair, I have a follow-up to any of the three that I guess about kind of the process for how the budget recommendations are developed. I know that your role basically is to be a liaison between the governor's office and the agencies. So does it start with just high-level targets? This is kind of about what we think we'd like to do, or is it a process of going out to the agencies and saying, what could you do about, or how much could you contribute to this, or what are your top priorities? I guess I'm wondering how much of it is kind of a top-down versus bottom-up process for developing a recommendation.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, it's definitely an iterative process, so it goes back and forth. Agencies are asked for information. Agencies are invited to provide their thoughts. Then they're also sometimes given targets to work within. It really depends on the budget context, depends on the governor and administration in place at that time, and kind of is a back and forth until you finally see the final result published. Madam Chair, members, moving to the next slide, it shows the budget bottom line. As you look there, it shows moving from the current biennium, fiscal year 8 and 9, to the proposed next biennium, 10 and 11, you would get a difference of 2.2% reduction, or $750 million. But it's important to note that there's some things moving in and out of the general fund for that calculation, the health care access fund being one of them, and that having the debt service paid temporarily kind of makes it hard to make an apples-to-apples comparison. But our best attempt at doing it shows about a 2.2% reduction. And that actually breaks down over the next two slides. Statewide, it shows what happens when you move from the current biennium to the proposed next biennium on the one slide, and then the next slide after that shows actually moving from the forecast base to the proposed next biennium for the major areas of spending. And what we've done on the next slide after that is actually show the state government comparisons for those same two movements. And it's important to note that, again, this is the state government bill as conceived of in the governor's budget. There's slight differences in how both the House and the Senate have grouped agencies. And also important to note that the increase that you see when moving from the forecast base is almost entirely made up of the major statewide technology projects. So they're statewide in nature. They just happen to be appropriated in this bill area. The next slide shows what would happen under this plan for the fiscal 12-13 biennium, and this also gets at the one-time question. So, with an eye toward the future, the governor's budget does make progress towards reducing the projected deficit that the forecast shows for the planning years. That's fiscal 10 and, or 12 and 13. The idea is it would be terribly disruptive to actually go the whole way now. There's a significant chance those revenues and expenditures will change quite a bit between now and then. We want to make some progress towards that, but may not make it all the way.
Madam Chair? To go back a slide or two, actually, on page 7, and it took me a little bit to decipher the two differences. Just the difference on the second slide, the second line versus the forecast, governor's budget versus forecast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if you can explain with significant cuts to Health and Human Services and capital projects, et cetera, job creating projects, how we can tell our constituents that we should have a 2.5 or 3% increase in state government compared to the forecast.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the increase is entirely related to those technology projects. So this area actually has spending reductions, which we'll get to in the next several slides, in the operating of the agencies, but there are some investments in statewide technology that are intended to position the state to operate better and to provide better services in the future.
Madam Chair, I'm not casting judgment on those investments, and I think that they're probably needed and probably important to long-term positioning and delivering services more efficiently. I think it's a difficult message to tell Minnesotans who are looking at sacrifices across the board. And if indeed there are investments that are worth making for the long term, maybe we should find a way to be able to structure the budget so that we can make those in some additional key areas. But that just stuck out for me, Madam Chair, an area that we're going to have to ask some real questions about in terms of priorities.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as part of the governor's budget solution, the next slide starts talking a little bit about that group of things called the spending reductions. And I'm going to start with going through the governor's recommended cabinet agency reductions to give you a sense for what was going on there. To start with, the Department of Administration reflects about 5% budget reduction in the governor's recommended budget. The way they stand to deal with that reduction is to eliminate 2.5 positions throughout the agency, as well as additional salary and operating reductions. They have eliminated or plan to eliminate some external consultants that are working on the enterprise performance improvement activities, and they also have done some adjustments as a result of an analysis they did that allocate their administrative time to other funds or other non-general fund activities. Second on the list is Minnesota Management and Budget. That number you see there represents 5% of their budget as well. The way they stand to deal with that reduction is to eliminate 8 positions throughout the department, reduce operating costs through space consolidation, server consolidation, and reduction of employee development. Third on the list is the office.
I guess we may have more detail on this, but can you give any sense of the 5% reduction that you just talked about in the areas, the ways that they're going to be reducing that? How does that break down? Are the employees, the lion's share, the server consolidation, line items as to how you get to this 5% reduction is not as useful as a sense of how much each of those contributes to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we're at MMB, right? Yeah. MMB plans to eliminate 8 positions throughout the department, and those positions will likely be involved in agency support and assistance, budget support, human resources management, administrative support, technical management and operations, and then also reduce operational costs. So some of the ideas there were space consolidation, actual physical space, server consolidation, that's probably actual, I'm guessing virtual and actual servers, and a reduction of employee development. And the agency will be able to provide more information on that when they do come before you.
Madam Chair, a follow-up. I think this is an across-the-board question that probably fits in here. I'm wondering if the governor has asked the political appointees that were they're not part of a collective bargaining agreement to either freeze wages or even take a wage cut as part of the solution, or and even himself. I mean, I hope as many legislators are, you know, we're not doing travel. For instance, I had to go on a conference out of my campaign fund this last week, and I'm just wondering if you could tell us if that's happening, if the governor has made that request, and if not, when we're going to hear that. I think it's good management and good positioning to do when you can.
Madam Chair, Representative, the governor issued an executive order, I think, in early December that asked for salary wage freezes among the cabinet agencies and to reduce travel, that kind of thing, if that's what you're asking. Madam Chair, there have been some directions over time, actually over the last year, that have both encouraged agencies to not hire unless absolutely necessary and instituted some additional controls to make sure only absolutely necessary positions have been hired for, and then have also directed to reduce or not give any sort of discretionary benefits that agencies have the ability to give within our current bargaining contracts or other things. And then the governor's state of the state, actually, he did announce his intention to go into bargaining to seek in the next round of contracts a wage freeze as well. So it's been kind of a steady ramping up, and then I think there's still more to come on that issue.
So, Madam Chair, this is not after a gotcha. This is actually just to understand kind of the status, and I think that the forecast is going to be probably worse than, as I think Representative Holbert alluded to. There's not yet been a freeze on a total freeze on discretionary benefits, and a freeze on salary, but not yet a request for a reduction in salary, even if it's just at the 2.2%, which is the total decrease in general fund expenditures. Is that right? That there hasn't been a request, and there hasn't been an order to actually cap and eliminate any discretionary benefits.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a really complex area, so I'd prefer, if it's okay, to actually get back to you in written form, because there's been a number of issues that have come, number of issues by the governor that have come forward, and it's really complex because we're currently under a set of contracts, and then we're going to go into bargaining for the new set of contracts that will govern during fiscal 10 and 11. So the contracts for the years we're budgeting for right now have not been negotiated. That actually starts now and continues. And so there's sort of two separate issues. Under current contracts, there's a limited ability to actually take back increases or whatever, but there is some discretionary areas that we can then control more. Does that make sense? So we can get back to you in written form with exactly what those are, if that would be helpful.
That would be helpful, Madam Chair. Just one clarifying question for my own understanding. And this is not at all to pick out individuals or even just classes of people. I'm just using them as an example because they're the easiest to identify. Commissioners, deputy commissioners, are they they're not under bargained contracts. They serve at the pleasure of the governor, do they not? Or do they have individual contracts? When you use the contract language, I'm just after those the political appointments that are assistant commissioners, deputies, and above.
Madam Chair, Representative, to make sure we get you the exact correct information, I would prefer to do it in written form. But, I mean, in general, they're governed by two things. A compensation plan, I think is what they're called. There's a manager's one, there's a commissioner's one. And then they're also governed by some statutes related to agency head salary. So the agency head salaries are capped in relationship to the governor's. So it's a pretty complex area. We can definitely get back to you with specific information on that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hogan, Madam Chair, and to your question, Representative Kalen, and I'm not by any means an expert, but I do recall a conversation that I had with the Commissioner of Finance. Sorry, I still call it that. But
that's the official name in this.
And he was sharing me the great consternation and backlash when the announcement went out that there would be no discretionary merit pay or benefit or whatever. So I know I mean, I don't know what levels of employees that are, it affected, but there was a broad system-wide announcement that a certain level of discretionary benefits that many had come to expect was not going to be distributed at the end of 08. So I do know that they have done quite a few things, but again, the details I'm not sure of.
Okay, go on.
Madam Chair, members, I think we're on to Office of Enterprise Technology. Their reduction also constitutes 5% of their forecast base. They plan to manage that process by eliminating 4 FTEs in Enterprise Planning and Management Program. The Department of Revenue number that you see there constitutes 5% of their non-compliance-related activities. So that's been excluded from that calculation. They plan to deal with their reduction to eliminating 51 FTEs through attrition and layoffs in their compliance support areas.
Madam Chair, what is that? What does the compliance support mean in real terms?
Well, what it means, we'll have revenue in here and they'll explain it to us, but that's the help that they give to people when you want them to voluntarily pay their taxes, and you think that what the problem is that they don't have good enough information or that sort of thing. So that's, you know, the compliance-related ones are the kind of compulsory, so looking for crimes that we put in afterwards. This is the sort of before stuff. But revenue will probably get into how, why this is a good idea.
And I'm sure that, I guess, so this follows up on my question about how these numbers are developed kind of internally. These are all basically 5% cuts for admin, finance, OET, and revenue. I guess that means that all of these departments can equally take the same amount of cut to their budget and have the same amount of impact on the services or work that they're doing. That number suggests to me that nobody in state government, including the legislature, is really digging into an agency, identifying what it does well and what it doesn't do well, and saying this is where you can cut, this is what you can't cut, and this is how we're going to develop a budget proposal that saves money. We don't do it here, and I've yet to be on a committee anyway that actually does a very good comparative analysis about how we're spending money. I think we depend as a part-time legislature on the administration taking on that role, really digging in and saying, you know, here's your core mission, here's where you're going, doing well. A 5% cut across the board suggests to me that really nobody's rolling up their sleeves to come up with good numbers on an agency-by-agency basis. How do you just sort of deliver the message and then they say, sure, is that the iterative process?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I think there actually are some distinctions in the across-the-board cut here for the Department of Revenue as an example, and I think on the next page when we talk about constitutional officers, you'll see some portions of that. In addition, the way some of these things are accounted for, particularly like in the Department of Administration, there are a number of things in their general fund that are characterized like the in lieu of rent appropriation that is paid on behalf of the legislature and the governor's office in ceremonial space, and their pass-through grants that go to public broadcasting. That's actually included in there. So if you actually took that out of their general fund operating, you'd actually see more of like about a 7% cut for them. And I think that those agencies could probably speak to the analysis they did internally better than we maybe could here. But there is some deviation.
My comment, as you probably could gather, is that I don't think that across the board sort of percentage changes in budgets is a very effective way to budget. Certainly I think the legislature often falls short in how we deal with those proposals, but I think the burden is on the administration to do a more detailed and thoughtful analysis of what the agencies have in place, and the fact that there are variables and yet it still all comes out of 5% indicates that it's just a policy decision to do 5%. It isn't based on any kind of real rigorous view of what they're doing.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
I guess, a comment that might actually turn into a question for the testifiers, and that is we were at a hearing earlier from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and what I was impressed by was the extent to which they had looked at their stated strategic objectives and key measures and had done a very thorough kind of return on investment analysis of the programs within their department to determine which ones to cut and how much. And I know Commissioner Badgerow laid out in quite a bit of detail for us within Department of Administration, at least, what their key strategies are, their key measures, and how the initiatives that they were choosing to fund and maybe not fund to varying degrees align to those strategies. So my sense is that the executive branch agencies have advanced a lot in terms of laying out those kind of strategic goals, the target outcomes. And we've had a number of conversations here, even in this committee meeting today, about the advisability of making significant investments for the long haul. So my sense, while we may not have visibility into all of it, is that if the pattern that I saw in some detail indeed were kind of exposed to us here today in terms of the rationality behind some of these decisions, and I don't see a 5% across the board cut. There's one slide in here that has a heading, 5% spending reductions under other agencies, but I think this is an uneven cutting, and it seems to me to have been a fairly strategic decision-making process. So maybe to follow on to Representative Winkler's earlier question about kind of the budgeting process, could you comment on kind of the alignment of the cuts and the investments relative to the stated strategies of the agency, and are these cuts in your mind kind of driven by strategy and outcomes and key priorities, or was it really just an across the board cut? I think that's a good question.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there was, as you said before, it was an iterative process. We've been back and forth with those agencies, and I guess I believe that their internal processes of analyzing those may be better presented by those agencies. But if you have particular questions you'd like answers about a particular agency, we'd be happy to get back to you on that.
I think it's a great point, and one where we should ask the agencies to come prepared to give us that level of assessment that we heard from Deed today. I'm hopeful we'll be pleased, but I think it's a great question.
Okay. Moving on to the next slide, called spending reductions for the legislature and constitutional officers. The number you see there for the legislature amounts to about 5% of the legislature's budget, and what that is a 5% reduction. In addition to that, a reduction that amounts to a rent increase for the building that you live in, called in lieu of rent in the state government budget bill. And I can get into that a little bit more later because that applies to the governor's office as well. As required by the statute, the governor must make recommendations for the legislature and constitutional officers, just to be clear, to arrive at a balanced budget. However, to meet the balanced budget, the governor has to recommend reductions in order to balance that budget. It makes no recommendations as to how those reductions might be made within these particular agencies. Moving on to the Attorney General, what you see there is a 5% reduction to their direct appropriated general fund amount. The governor's office is also 5% reduction plus an in lieu of rent increase. The Secretary of State is also 5% of their forecast base, and their forecast base is changes year over year. So that's why you see the two different numbers there. And finally, you see the state auditor, and that is actually 5% of their general fund appropriation, excluding their audit practice. And the reason that is excluded is because they earn fees that recover as non-dedicated funds 100% of that practice. So they earn fees that cover that those expenses. They go back to the general fund. Just to spend a minute on this in lieu of rent piece, I'm sure you're familiar with it. What this is an offset to an increase of $500,000 per year, to the Department of Administration. And the Department of Administration actually administers all the plant management for the state office building, the Capitol complex, and the ceremonial space, and the governor's residence. They actually haven't had an increase in this area to cover costs such as depreciation, bond interest, salaries, and expenses for the maintenance related to this program since 2004. And so you can see why utilities might have increased over time, things like that. in order to minimize the impact on the general fund overall, we basically, the governor's recommending an increase of $500,000 per year to administration and reduced on a per square foot occupied basis to the legislature and the governor's office. So that's what that is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you define ceremonial space?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's the space out in the Capitol complex where all the memorials are, the green space in front of the Capitol that requires maintenance.
And Madam Chair, if I might, then who pays for the rotunda?
That's included in the Capitol complex, so mostly the Senate is in that building.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, Ms. Boyd, does the governor's office budget includes or excludes the governor's staff who are, my understanding is, are paid for by the agency budgets and then on loan to the governor's office? Does that make sense? So in addition to the department liaisons, liaisons from the governor's office. My understanding, I correct in understanding that those are actually paid for by the department budget, not by the governor's office budget.
Madam Chair, Representative, the number you see here is the general fund direct appropriation, so it would not include any special revenue. Related to the interagency agreement.
Okay, and so so those are indeed, and I think Ms. Roberts is nodding her head in agreement.
Yeah, just to clarify, there are several state employees that work for the governor's office that are paid by other state agencies, but some of them are actually paid in a proportion where either one state agency will pay a proportion of their salary and the governor's office might also pick up a part of it, or several state agencies might pay a portion of that employee salary, and I can get you the detail on it. So I think the direct appropriation does pick up a portion of some of those salary costs, but other costs are within state agency budgets, but we can get more detail on that for you.
Are these people physically in the governor's office or physically in the agency?
Madam Chair, I believe that there are, I'd like to get clarification on that. I think most of them are physically in the governor's office, but there have been a couple special advisors that were paid through interagency agreements, but that also works for the governor's office. I don't know what the current status of that is.
And Madam Chair, to this point, can you also get the information on the Washington, D.C. office? I know a number of years ago, the costs of the Washington, D.C. office were assigned proportionately relative to the amount of federal funds that were received. So in other words, transportation and health and human services together paid like 80% of the cost of the lobbying in the office in Washington, D.C. So I'd be curious to see if that's still the case or not as well.
Madam Chair and Representative Holbrook, it is still the case, and you'll actually see that in the governor's office detailed numbers that's reflected in the special revenue line, but we can get you the detail. I think there's 14 agencies currently that are paying for that office, and I believe that the projected spending is going to go down in 10 and 11 for that office.
And Madam Chair, just a much more global, maybe even 50 or 60,000 foot observation, but on the governor's budget priority narrative on the bottom of page 2, the last bullet being increased government reform and accountability. I hope the word transparency is actually just not deliberately excluded, but I think this goes to the point where sometimes it can be very difficult for the public to understand. You know, I think when they hear governor's office, they think more political rather than actual policy, when I think some of us know that they do some good policy work out of the folks that we work with, sometimes they're more inherently political. I think it would be helpful to be able to explain to our constituents in a much more transparent way how these interagency pieces work and why there's a department liaison in addition to somebody in the governor's office and whether that's even necessary and those pieces. I would like to be able to explain to my constituents pretty much every single line in our budget, and I think this is one of the most difficult things for me to wrap my brain around, let alone turn into a sentence for somebody emailing us.
when you do it, send it to the rest of us.
All of us. Ms. Roberts?
Okay. Okay. Right. Continue.
On our next slide, we're talking about a couple of three different agencies, smaller agencies that fall under your purview of this committee. Those are the Office of Administrative Hearings, the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board, and the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The governor is working to provide agencies as much flexibility to manage these reductions as possible, knowing that they're a little bit more difficult for smaller agencies to deal with. In the Office of Administrative Hearings, they plan to meet these reductions through salary savings and savings on supplies, and from what I know, they don't expect it to significantly impact their operations. The Capital Area Planning Board plans to meet their reduction through a number of mechanisms, including salary savings. The salaries represent approximately 83% of this, this board's budget. The Campaign Finance Board plans to accommodate their reduction.
Capital Area Architectural Board, as I recall, they have to work with any project that's being planned in the St. Paul area. Don't they get reimbursed from those projects? And is there, does this reduction have any effect on what they might do in the St. Paul area?
Madam Chair, I believe they do generate fees from some of those services. What they have said is that it's possible that this kind of reduction may slow their response time and their ability to update their zoning procedures and policies, that type of thing.
But does it also impact their ability to get paid back from some of the projects that they work with?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. Not my knowledge, but I can get back to you on that specifically.
Okay.
As I was saying, as it relates to the Campaign Finance Board, my understanding is that they plan to deal with the reduction here by eliminating out-of-state travel, potentially a membership in a national organization for state regulatory agencies. And possibly through salary savings, because this is their salaries are approximately 86% of their operating budget as well.
Okay. Madam Chair, I think you've answered it. It was regarding the campaign finance. I mean, usually I think of backers as just really responding to the responsibilities that they have. And if you cut them too far, how are they supposed to operate would be my question.
Madam Chair?
You mentioned limiting out-of-state travel or something. Does that truly add up to 5% of their budget?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it amounts to $37,000 per year in their operating budget.
Again, we'll hear more completely from these groups when they hear what the effect would be. Was their proposal to eliminate the contributions back to campaigns, the matching funds to campaigns, is that included in this, or was that not a proposal of the governor's office?
Madam Chair, are you speaking about this is all under the Department of Revenue? They've got a couple of different programs, so I just want to be clear which one you're...
I'm talking about the tax deduction. Yeah, right.
There's a proposal under the Department of Revenue, but not under
Revenue, and it doesn't come into this.
Correct.
Okay. What? Oh. Okay. I'm informed that that's tracked in the tax committee, not in this committee. Okay.
Okay. Moving on to the next page, there were a number of agencies who were kept at their forecast base level of spending in the governor's recommendation. Due to deployment and the ongoing role in protecting our state, the governor is not recommending any reductions to the Department of Military Affairs budget. The governor's budget also keeps the investment board at its forecast base level appropriation, given the important task managing the state investments during difficult economic times. Retirement contingent and tort claims accounts all stay at forecast base level as well. There's also three agencies that fall under this that operate outside the general fund. the Gambling Control Board, and the Racing Commission receive direct appropriations from fees on industries they regulate. Governor's budget keeps these agencies at forecast-based level. The governor also recommends the lottery spend the forecasted amount on its operation. Moving on to the Department of Administration, there's a number of initiatives that are included in the governor's budget under the Department of Administration. I'll just go through them quickly. I think you've probably seen a number of them before. The first on the list would be cooperative purchasing, expansion. This is actually an expansion of what the Department of Administration already does. And what it does is it requires Minnesota cities, counties, and townships to use the state's negotiated contract on their purchase services. This is actually doesn't have any impact at all on the general fund. It's a revolving fund, 941, where they generate fees from the vendors that are involved in these contracts and support admin services to that. The second item on this list is ongoing operating support for the real property system. This is a system that originally in 2007 session, there was $2.5 million appropriated for this system for the development of it. In addition, there were contributions made from different agencies for $1.825 million. For a total of $4.325 million that's already been invested in the system. What it does is it basically inventories and tracks all the property, plant, and equipment enterprise-wide in the state. So it's been a cooperative effort from a number of agencies. And starting this summer, I believe the implementation is planned to be done. So what this number provides, $844,000 per year, is for ongoing support for that system.
Madam Chair, this can be, I guess, addressed with admin, but do you happen to know if that's a contracted amount as part of the purchase price of the system, or is something we're obligated for? It just seems like almost a million dollars a year for ongoing operations of that system seems fairly expensive.
Madam Chair, Representative, some of the things that are covered by the ongoing operating are listed here, the software subscription, basically the license they need to keep using it from the vendor that they selected. It's for a database administrator and some costs at the Office of Enterprise Technology related to the system.
Again, we'll hear more about that from the department. So start stacking up these questions. Are you ready to go?
Okay. On the next slide, a couple more initiatives from the Department of Administration. We talked, I kind of explained previously the in lieu of rent, so I won't get into that again unless you have questions. In addition, the governor is recommending an added amount of $145,000 per year for the SMART initiative. This is an initiative that helps streamline small agencies on HR and policies and financial management according to state regulations. This is a new initiative in the 2007 session, and based on its successfulness and the need for additional agencies to receive services, that appropriation has been increased to $395,000 per year total.
It's something I really seem to have a mental block about, and I've been unable to understand it no matter how many times it's been explained to me. So maybe let's try it once more. And that's the in lieu of rent line. Would you, somebody please explain how that works again? How it worked in the past and how it's supposed to work now. And I apologize if everyone else completely understands this and I'm the only one who has problems with it.
Madam Chair, Representative, the in lieu of rent is basically the rent that the legislature pays. It's every other I apologize, that made it sound really simple and actually it's not. Every other agency in state government pays a rent directly based upon an agreement with the Department of Administration based upon the square footage that they occupy. The legislature and the governor's office and the ceremonial space does not pay based upon the square footage. They just get this appropriation, and that appropriation is meant to cover the cost of utilities, depreciation, maintenance, bond interest, any capital projects that were related to these spaces. And whereas the agreements for other agencies are renegotiated every year with the Department of Administration or every 2 years, they never get renegotiated within this appropriation. And so as the cost of utilities rise and as the cost of repairs increase, particularly for the state office building and the Capitol building, that gets more and more expensive for the Department of Administration to absorb. And so that's what we're looking for here with the increase.
What if we decided we treat every agency this way? Not charging any of the agencies rent, and just gave the Department of Administration an appropriation to manage state real estate and offices and so forth. What effect would that have?
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's partly in an effort to be more accountable and transparent in state government to say how much did these agencies actually cost, and the Department of Administration is very detailed about what they know what it costs to run these buildings. And I think once you get to a big appropriations level, it's harder to split that out and say what do each of them cost. So I think you would lose some transparency to do that. But that said, maybe Commissioner Badger has an opinion on that.
It'd be a nice big number to do a cut in.
Madam Chair, is this basically an inflationary increase in the cost of running the space? I mean, is that kind of what is driving this? It just costs more year after year to run the space, so you need to increase the appropriation for it?
It's partly, Madam Chair, Representative, it's partly an inflationary cost, but that cost is related to how much energy actually costs to run the buildings, how much any kinds of structural repairs cost that over time. Say there was a big something fell down in the Capitol building and they had to use capital money to do that. That bond interest is spread out over the years and included in those costs. Any taxes related to those costs are included in there. So it's a number of things.
Well, it's interesting, Madam Chair, that this is one of the few places in the budget that we'll see where there's actually an acknowledgement that it costs more and more to run buildings and institutions around the state every year, and that most of the time we just force everybody to eat those inflationary costs in these budgets, but not for the legislature or the governor.
And Madam Chair, to return to my original question of Ms. Reed on the energy savings revenue bonding opportunity, I think that if we were to be extremely aggressive and go and I know that that Mr. Rhodes could actually get us that data from Mr. Wazlowski in terms of the aggregate amount of energy that we have used and the aggregate energy savings potential in there. It is in the tens of millions, I think, is the last number I saw, if not more than that. So this in lieu of rent could actually be, we could actually bond against the in lieu of rent increase and call it energy savings and pay it forward, as Representative Bigham called it.
Getting all sorts of ideas. Okay? You'll get your plan. Oh, Representative Seven was the one who wanted the plan. It's coming out bit by bit. Okay. Keep going.
Last on this list is an appropriation for the Office of Grants Management. This is an office at the Department of Administration that provides support to the grant-seeking public and trained the state agencies on grant-making and monitoring. It also investigates reported fraud and waste in state grant awards. There was an appropriation in 2007 for this, but it was not ongoing in 2008, so the governor's recommendation restores the funding for this office.
Okay, this is the one where my solution was to do what the federal government does when it does grants and put a percentage on the grant as overhead and then to collect that for to do a completely transparent grant management one. So that's something we may come back to again.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, the next slide are the initiatives for the Office of Enterprise Technology. And the first initiative here is the data center consolidation. And this is a one-time amount of money, $16.5 million for the biennium. And the idea here is to reduce the state's IT vulnerability and consolidate most of the executive branch, state agency, data centers, and facilities into an enterprise operation. And the impetus for this is really that OEP and its agency partners contracted for an in-depth assessment of the state's executive branch data centers as they currently are. And that assessment determined that the limited resources over the years, coupled with centralized management, had actually resulted in the state assuming too much risk in the operation of our data centers. And that affects the protection of our data as well as just the availability of the systems that are run on those servers. And through consolidation, the goal is to reduce the square footage and protect the state's data and availability. So the square footage could actually be reduced by as much as 50%, and the number of physical servers by as much as 30, could also achieve a 38% reduction in energy use and provide some better disaster recovery options than currently available. And so how this initiative is structured is to fund the actual consolidation process over the next 2 years. And in general, and OET can go into this further, but in general, there's a section of the money that's to prepare the state to contract for some help to do this, to make some plans, to work with agencies to figure out where we need to go. That would occur over a portion of fiscal 10. Then there's also money to do the actual consolidation, the picking up and moving of servers, the purchasing of new servers, the virtual consolidation, things like that. And then the remainder of the amount is actually a transition to paying rates for this. So similar to the Department of Administration, Office of Enterprise Technology does have a fund, a revolving fund, where they charge agencies for their service. And this money would help transition agencies to paying for that. And the reason there is a transition time is the assessment found we actually don't spend enough on this, that in order to maintain our data and our system availability at a level that's appropriate for state government, that we would need to transition to putting a little more effort in this area. So that's how this is structured. And so under this proposal, agencies would then begin paying the full chargeback rate in fiscal 12. The second item on this list is the enterprise-wide planning. Excuse me, I somehow lost my notes on this one. This one is a system you're familiar with. It was actually launched in 2007 with an appropriation of $7.5 million. So what this proposal is to actually complete the rollout of the system to the remaining agencies. And that's estimated to cost $38 million over 8 years. And the idea is to expand the system to the remaining agencies to achieve the goal of one-stop online access to occupational and business licenses issued by the state. And as
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that this area calls for a 10% surcharge, is that right, on certain licensing? Oh, I thought it was 10%.
Madam Chair, Representative, the way that this initiative would be funded is through a temporary user fee. It's structured to be a surcharge of 10% with a floor of $10. So, of course, anything that has a cost up to $100, it would be 10, and then anything that's $100 or more, it would be the 10%.
So, Madam Chair, what are we talking? What is a typical transaction? 10% of?
There's a wide range. I think OET is better able to, I know their, if I can find it here, their initiative actually goes into that. Madam Chair, their initiative says the majority of licenses would be subject to a surcharge between $10 and $50. Some commercial licenses, like hospitals, cost over $3,000, and so therefore their surcharges have actually ranged from $300 to $900, depending. But they found that in their research so far, the majority would be between $10 and $50. And they can better answer that question when they come up.
We will get back to you. But I think the question that's being raised is, Are some groups being charged double, and is this being done fairly over all groups that have to be licensed to pay for it? I think those are the two questions that we'd like, which we'll obviously give to OET when they come here.
Madam Chair, can you repeat
the two questions? Were the questions of fairness, is this fairly being expanded to, for all people who use electronic licensing, and two, are there any groups that are being charged double? because they either were in charge when it was first initiative or they're being charged. They were charged, now they're being charged again. It's not an accusation, it's just a question at this point.
And Madam Chair, in general, the surcharge would be charged on all licenses that are going to be actually migrated to the system. The exception there would be the two pilot agencies, so that's Post Board and EMS Board, have already been migrated. They were paid for with the direct appropriations. Their license holders would not be subject to the surcharge. But otherwise, all those licenses that would be moved to the system would then pay. So to the extent that any agencies have already made investments in another system that may or may not have had a surcharge, it would be in addition to that. And the idea there is to bring everyone to the same enterprise statewide system as was the state goal.
So some were paid for with the direct appropriation and were never charged an electronic licensing fee, and others that are being charged an electronic licensing fee are now being subjected to a surcharge besides that. Is that correct or not correct?
Madam Chair, all licenses that would be migrated to the system will be subject to the surcharge in order to migrate them to the system.
But the ones that are on the system are not subject.
The two exceptions are the two pilot agencies, because the legislature did appropriate an amount of money to build the system and then migrate those two. So their license holders' contribution was covered by the direct appropriation already made.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So by temporary, you're talking about the 8-year period that's set forth in the slide.
Madam Chair, Representative, the surcharge is structured to occur over an 8-year period, but each agency's license holders would pay for 6 years within that. The idea of having it spread out a little bit is to, as closely as possible, match the timing of the surcharge that they're paying to the timing of actually being migrated to the system. Now, you can't get exact, and OEP can go into more detail about the process we're going through to determine that, but that does leave some flexibility in there. And as I had mentioned, the surcharge is expected to raise $38 million over the 8-year period. The annual amount will actually range then, depending on which license are being charged at any time, probably between $3 and $7 million. So the numbers you see reported in the governor's budget are actually an average, so there's a $4.75 million per year. But again, it'll vary depending on which licenses are being charged at any given time.
Madam Chair, just one last question. Are there any, and I know I can look for myself here in the more detailed budget information, but offhand, if you know, are there any of these other initiatives that we've seen on the past couple pages, are there any other surcharges embedded in there, temporary or otherwise, that you know of?
Madam Chair, members, there aren't any other surcharges in this section of the budget.
Well, it's getting close to the end, so Representative Fagel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually just got an email from my favorite constituent, who happens to be my brother, asking about why he's getting a $10 surcharge on his boiler license. My question is, what if you don't meet the threshold that you need to cover this through the licensing? And my other question is, what if you exceed it? Like, if we start, I know we have a licensing subcommittee or division, and if we start licensing tattoo artists and body piercing and some of these other industries that aren't licensed right now, and they go through this procedure and you exceed it and there's an excess, how does that, do you then have to repay the general fund for the appropriation that we gave earlier? Or, I mean, I'm just wondering, like, what if you don't meet your goal, either fall short or exceed it?
I don't think this is a dedicated fund. I think this is, mm-hmm. Is it a dedicated fund? Oh. Well.
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, this would be structured as a special revenue fund. Okay. So the receipts would come into the special revenue fund. Therefore, I mean, we'd have to specify in the language if for some reason the funding came in above what was needed for the contract and for the operating expenses of the state, then the language would need to specify where that money would go. But at this point, with the contract not signed and this whole process to go through, it's hard to know whether that eventuality would happen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Is that rider language going to be put in there for when you do
eventually, hopefully, sign the contract?
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, I can't recall exactly what's in the language being drafted, but certainly an attempt we made to cover that issue, and if not, that would be an opportunity to update the language as it moves through the session, but we'll definitely try to get that in there.
Thank you.
Let's keep going and see if we can finish, and then we'll get back to questions.
If there aren't any questions on e-licensing, Madam Chair, I'll move to MMB's initiative. Minnesota Management and Budget has two initiatives in the governor's budget. The first one is the MAPS replacement. This is the project to replace the state's aging accounting and procurement systems. The goal there is to provide some stable infrastructure, improve business controls, and provide better information access and transparency. And as you probably recall, having seen this initiative before, the existing systems are mainframe-based. Their applications were selected in 1992 and brought online in 1995. They're now unsupported technology that's nearly obsolete and at risk for major failure. And this is the accounting procurement systems upon which all government activity is based. The new systems proposed would be off-the-shelf software with limited customizations, allowing the state to more easily keep the system up to date at less expense. And under this plan, the vendor contract would be in place by early fiscal 2010, with a planned implementation date then of fiscal 12. And the cost of the system in the governor's budget is recommended to be spread over 10 years using lease purchase financing, which I'm going to discuss in a couple slides after this because I know there have been some questions on that issue. The second initiative I believe you've also heard some about already, it's the Financial Oversight and Assistance Initiative. This would be $700,000 per year, and it creates an internal control unit to keep pace with agencies' training and support needs and to expand oversight of state bond authorizations. And it adds six staff for internal controls, and that is responding directly to some legislative auditor concerns and some concerns the legislature and the governor's office have expressed. The bonding oversight would be two staff, and that really expands our current staff. We've had essentially the same staff overseeing bond authorities for about a decade, and this would increase them by two, given that the bond authorizations are increasing in amount and also complexity. So to dig a little more into the lease purchase financing, we have a series of slides here. The first is just a high-level view. The lease purchase financing that's proposed for MAPS, and then you'll see later for integrated tech. The benefits of this approach are to actually spread the development costs of these core IT systems over the life of the system. The drawbacks are, as with any kind of borrowing, it does create a long-term obligation of the state and does add interest and lease administration expense. And because we have to go to market, then we would increase the risk and uncertainty somewhat over just making a direct appropriation. The bottom line, though, is this does provide a viable option for accessing capital for these major core IT systems, even in a time of financial trouble. So the next slide shows a little more of how this would work. It's a financing tool that provides the upfront capital we would need for the major systems project in exchange for a fixed set of lease payments over 10 years. So private investors on the other side actually buy these instruments, and they're called certificates of participation, and then they receive a fixed rate of return. And these would not be secured with an asset like you typically think of a lease. They're actually backed entirely by the amount that we would from time to time appropriate to pay the lease payment. And because of this, they are not actually backed by the full faith and credit of the state like general obligation bonds. Therefore, they are slightly riskier for investors. They're not backed by that same statewide property tax we would assess if we couldn't make our GO bond payments. But the state has a very high credit rating in the area of these kind of financial instruments, and therefore, it's a slightly higher interest we expect to pay than GO bonds. And the next slide just shows how this would actually break down then for the MAPS project. You'll see there it shows the total principal is composed of the project cost, nearly $70 million. The administration, similar to how we have bond sale expenses, we'd have administrative expenses for this, and then the interest cost. So the annual payment would be the $8.975 million, and the total over 10 years would then be close to $90 million.
scoot over to the mic here. The only initiative for the Department of Revenue is the completion of the integrated tax system. And just as a review, this request for funding is for completion of the project that was started with an appropriation from the 2007 legislature. That was $12 million, and then redirection of agency funds from old systems, $11 million. The new system replaces 142 different computer applications running on 11 different platforms for 28 different tax types. The new system provides a more accurate and timely system that will mitigate the risk of system failure. It'll also allow the department to expand current services and will enhance capabilities to detect non-compliance. The project was started in March 2008, and rollout one was just successfully completed in December, and that included sales and use taxes, Minnesota care taxes, petroleum taxes, insurance taxes, and mortgage and registry taxes. Rollout 2 is expected to be completed in December of 2009, and that'll include corporate taxes, withholding taxes, and other business income taxes. Rollout 3 is expected to be completed in December of 2010, and that will include the individual income tax. And finally, Rollout 4 will include cigarette, gambling, and liquor taxes, and is expected to be completed in December of 2011. If you move to the next slide, that just goes through the lease purchase financing for, I lost my notes here, for the integrated tax system, and it just shows the project cost with the administration fees of $50,000, and then interest at 5%, and that brings the total annual payment to $2.117 million.
Okay. Madam Chair, the second to last slide there is actually just for informational purposes. There are several agencies that are included in the governor's budget under state government that are actually in different agency jurisdictions within the House. So just to note, if folks are interested, the cultural councils, the four of them are also in the budget with a 5% reduction for each one. And the Amateur Sports Commission has two initiatives. One is to reduce the payment that goes to Minneapolis to pay the Target Center debt service, and the other is actually to increase the appropriation for Amateur Sports Commission to make up some of the forecast-based reduction they had under current law. And then finally, for our final slide, we just wanted to let you know that our budget documents, the governor's budget documents, are all available online at our website. I know you have the majority of them in your book. I know staff also handed out a sheet, the one-pager that says improved state services. That covers a lot of the eager projects in this area. But just to give you a sense, as you flip through the budget book for any given agency, you'll first find, for the cabinet agencies, a transmittal letter. That's the agency's chance to really highlight what's going on with their agency's budget and operations. It's actually really informative. Then you'll see a short profile for the agency. It's intended to be a 2 to 3 page description of everything that they do. And next you'll see a fiscal page that shows the agency overview, and that's that kind of single page snapshot of all the money in that agency area. The next page after that actually shows the change summary. So that's where you'll see how you get from the forecast base to the governor's recommended amount given the different change items proposed by the governor. You'll also find a couple page description of each of the change items in the governor's budget. So if you're looking for more narrative information, that's in there. And then for the larger and more complex agencies, you'll also see additional pages that cover more narrative of their different program areas, as well as some fiscal pages at a lower level for the different programs and budget activities. All of that is available, I think, in your books or for other agencies online. And again, if you do have any additional questions, feel free to pass them through the fiscal analyst to us, and we can connect you to answers.
Okay. Are there any last minute representative questions?
I'm sorry, I was just trying to figure this out, Madam Chair. And is the information, did you just say the information on the various councils on Black Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, is that in here, or is it just online?
Madam Chair, Representative, they're now covered in the cultural and outdoors resources finance?
In the House.
They're in a different committee. And I know in previous years, sometimes they've ended up back here at some point. So we just want to make sure that we mentioned it if that was an interest of the committee. But they are currently separate.
I'm interested in the concept of the data center. I know. Have you looked at anything else other than lease purchasing, like general obligation bonding? Because it is, I gathered, part of it is supposed to be a building, some kind of capital enhancement or revenue bonding.
Madam Chair, OEC can definitely go into more detail on what the options are there, but the governor's initiative is to lease space for the central operation. Some of the disaster recovery sites may be converted space that we currently have, but the idea is for the central operation to be leased.
How many years does the government, first of all, how many years is the target center repayment supposed to go on? When is that supposed to stop?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure when Minneapolis's debt service ends on that. They would be able to provide that information, but the understanding is the original agreement was structured to have the state portion paid for 15 years, and the way that's working is that the standing appropriation was actually written into law with no expiration date, and so it will stay there and be in the forecast as an expenditure until that appropriation is repealed in statute.
And how many times has the governor recommended that it be repealed?
Madam Chair, I know it was a recommendation last year. I'm not sure if it has been in previous years. It may have come from both sides at some point.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, well, thanks. Okay. Well, thank you very much for getting through all this. Okay. You should leave your books unless you're going to be responsible for bringing them back. You can take them if you want to, but then you have to bring them back. You can take it.
You're going to say that?
What?